Welcome to St. Louis on the Air. I'm Don Marsh. A little later in the program, we'll be talking with former Cardinal manager Tony La Russa. He may be out of baseball, but that's just about all he's been talking about these last days. But first, a new study offers some disturbing information about young African Americans in today's society. The bottom line is, the more stressful their lives, the greater the probability they will turn to violence. The study was conducted by our two guests, Dr. Lorena Estrada Martinez, Associate Professor of Social Work at the Brown School of Social Work at Washington University. Her colleague, Dr. Cleopatra Howard Caldwell, is Director of the Center for Research on Ethnicity, Culture, and Health at the University of Michigan School of Public Health. Ladies, thanks so much for being with us. Nice to have you.
It's great to be here.
Dr. Estrada Martinez, let me begin with you and just get some background on why this study was conducted in the first place.
Well, there's been a lot of research previously on the impact of stress on health, mental health, and behaviors among African-Americans, and specifically African-American adolescents. So this particular study was giving us an opportunity to look at the period of young adulthood, sort of the 19 through 25 age range, where most adolescents have already sort of moved past violent behaviors. But some of the young adults obviously continue to engage in violent behavior. So that was one of the main interests that we had in conducting the study. We really focused on different kinds of stressors, sort of stressors that were happening in multiple life domains, if you will. So we looked at financial strain, financial stressors, neighborhood stressors, sort of fear of crime and what was going on in the neighborhood. We looked at parenting stress, since this is sort of the age where people begin to have children and it's more normative. We looked at racial discrimination and also at daily stress, essentially the ability to handle daily hassles in life. And that was moving forward from a more general perception of stress into more specific kinds of stressors.
Dr. Caldwell, what I took from what I've read of the report is that racial discrimination was one of the very principal stressors.
Racial discrimination did emerge, especially for predicting violence. And that's something that we pay a lot of attention to, because this is one of those stressors that tends to be very persistent, particularly over time. And that's one of the things that was important about the work that we did, because we were able to track it for a long period of time and determine that among all of the kinds of stressors that we looked at, racial discrimination, when we were talking about predicting violence, was the most persistent.
Were either of you surprised by that, Dr. Estrada Martinez?
No, there's been a lot of previous work that has looked at racial discrimination and that has found that links with violent behaviors in particular. What was surprising is that other kinds of stressors were not as important. Stressors that were really critical during the period of adolescence sort of just stopped being as important when people become young adults. Neighborhood stress in particular has been shown for decades now that it is a highly influential when it comes to adolescent behaviors and youth violence for African Americans and for many other groups, essentially all groups. But it stopped being important later on.
Dr. Caldwell, when we talk about neighborhood stressors, what are we talking about?
A lot of times we're talking about the kinds of crime that's committed in neighborhoods where people live. We're also talking about people's perception of safety. So we are talking about people, this is their homes are located there, and people are really feeling uncomfortable because of the kinds of circumstances they find themselves in, oftentimes not to their own doing, but they're not feeling comfortable in those kinds of environments. So we're looking at those kinds of issues when we're talking about neighborhoods.
What do we know about the connection in terms of why it generates violence as opposed to other things, perhaps?
Racial discrimination in particular, we actually know that it does predict several outcomes, not just violent behaviors. We know that it affects physical health, for example, and there's been a lot of studies that are looking into that, and also the interaction between racial and neighborhood stress on health. In particular, there's a few schools of thought on how racial discrimination affects risk for youth violence, and some of it has to do with sort of the accumulation of stressors over time. So it's not just one overt experience of racial discrimination, but rather sort of the more subtle, daily, common experiences that adolescents have and that might kind of push somebody over the edge, if you will. and they become violent in a particular situation.
Is there a particular kind of violence that is associated with this? Are we talking about murders? Are we talking about assaults? Are we talking about all of these kinds of things?
In most cases, we are talking about things that are less violent than murder and assault, because we're talking about young people at this point. And oftentimes, it could be fights. Mm-hmm. So it could be the way they manifest anger in many ways. And oftentimes, we're talking about, when we're looking at the stressors, we're talking about things that have accumulated over a period of time. So it can be kinds of explosive situations that young people engage in often. In this study, we find that the levels of violence was relatively low. It wasn't like it was extremely high, but it oftentimes is in response to an accumulation of stressors that may have been happening in their life over time.
Do these stressors have the same reaction among non-blacks? I mean, discrimination would be less of an issue, I think, among young whites, but what about some of the other things that contribute?
Well, this particular study didn't look at any other group. So what I'm about to talk about is really based on the literature and not our particular study. But yes, all of these stressors do have an important effect among all of the minority populations in the country. A lot of my work has centered on Latinos and different Latino groups, and there's certainly a lot of evidence to point that certain kinds of racial experiences of racial discrimination can lead to violent behaviors. Certainly neighborhoods and financial stress during adolescence, they do affect every single racial and ethnic group in the country.
And go ahead.
Oh, I was going to say that part of what we're talking about is this kind of fighting that occurs. And one of the reasons why we are labeling it as violent behavior, because we talk about the fighting that occurs even when kids are younger. And when we get to this particular age group, we're expecting some of this behavior would diminish. And we get concerned when we're in this age group and people are still engaging as an expression of their anger through this kind of physical altercation, through the kind of inappropriate, if you will, at this age group, still engaging in this kind of behavior. So we're not necessarily talking about the murders that we're referring to earlier on. We're talking about at a developmental stage when youth are beginning to transition into adulthood, that there are other ways of dealing with some dissatisfaction, that some youth are still now using this kind of violence where you would expect it to diminish by this point, which suggests that they're doing some ineffective coping with the kinds of stressors that they're facing.
What precisely is the age group that was part of this study?
So our sample was between 19 and 25 years of age, and we looked at them at different points in time. This is part of a larger study that has been following a group of youth since they were in ninth grade in Flint, Michigan, and we are currently in year 12, I believe, of data
yes.
collection. So we've been following these folks for a very, very long time.
You know, I would think that this would be a greater issue amongst 12 to 19-year-olds, for instance, as opposed to 19 to 25. You're both nodding.
Mm-hmm. Right.
Yes.
Then go ahead and respond.
Right. That's why we're looking at emerging adulthood and looking at this problem at this particular stage. So you think about it, when you're looking at a 4-year-old, they're some of the most violent kids you're going
sure.
to see.
Mm-hmm.
But that's quite age appropriate. So as you're moving up the ladder, you still continue to see kids engaging in ways of handling or expressing, if you will, their anger in certain kinds of ways. As we become adults, if we disagree around certain kinds of things, we wouldn't expect ourselves to engage in fighting behavior, for example, as a way of settling disputes. So when we continue to see this behavior, this is an area that we get concerned about. And we are saying this is an area where we really need to intervene. But we also are trying to understand what may be at a root cause of these kinds of ways of responding. And we oftentimes look at the individual saying, well, this person is not coping very well. But we're also trying to understand the circumstances under which people are living that might contribute to some of these ways of responding.
Are you suggesting that after the age of 25, this tendency toward violence dissipates?
Actually, after the age of 18, the tendency for violence dissipates. Much of the research that has been done for many decades has pointed to sort of an age curve when it comes to violent behavior. So people begin to engage in more, first in sort of aggressive behaviors and then into violent behaviors into adolescence. And that sort of peaks between 16 and 17 years of age. And then it goes quickly down as people go into young adulthood.
Even though those stressors might remain.
Those stressors might remain, but there are alternative ways of handling it. But what's interesting about this is, remember, around age 18 is also when we oftentimes send our young people off to war. And they learn other kinds of things. And then they return home, mm-hmm. and they don't unlearn certain kinds of things. So a lot of things are situation specific.
We also, at that age, have a tendency to send the bad ones off to prison, where that creates another dynamic, does it not?
Absolutely. It's very interesting.
Let me just interject here a little bit, because you said the bad ones off to prison.
I'm talking about the criminals' convictions, people who have been convicted. But go ahead.
Interesting, because one of the things that we are also interested in suggesting is that there are some historical injustices that happen in country and mm-hmm. in this country. And definitely there are some people in prison who need to be there. But there are also some differential reasons and differential convictions that happen to people, and they end up in prison initially mm-hmm. for reasons that are out of their control. And they may end up with a lifetime history of being in prison and end up exactly where you're talking about. But we also need to understand how people get there in the first place, and they're not equal opportunities.
You know, I almost think that's another issue. I'm making
Definitely.
Reference to the ones who do deserve to be there. That's those.
But
are
we
the
want
bad
to be clear,
I'm talking about.
Right?
No, I understand that. I
just wanted to make two points. First, yes, and even in research, when we do this kind of work, when we talk about certain kinds of behaviors, including violent behaviors among adolescents, we label it as delinquency. But once we reach the age of 18, we start labeling it as crimes. Because
right.
if an adult did the same thing, they would potentially be charged and go to jail. But I totally agree with what Dr. Caldwell is talking about. I mean, there's certainly a lot of evidence that for the same types of crimes, young black men get and young Latino men get much more severe kinds of sentences than a young white man would get.
I don't think there's any question about that, and I certainly agree with that. As a matter of fact, we've had laws passed here in Missouri with regard to cocaine, for instance, mm-hmm. Crack and powdered cocaine, the disparity in sentencing, that sort of thing. So it's definitely there. I don't think anybody would dispute that. I have to take a break. We are talking about stress and the role it plays in violence, particularly among young African Americans. My guest in studio, Dr. Lorena Estrada Martinez, Associate Professor of Social Work at the Brown School of Social Work at Washington University, and Dr. Cleopatra Howard Caldwell, Director of the Center for Research on Ethnicity, Culture, and Health, the University of Michigan School of Public Health. We'd like to get your input on this. What do you think about what we're talking about? Give us a call at 382-8255. That's 382-TALK. You can send us an email at talk@stlpublicradio.org. We'll take a tweet at STL on Air. You can also reach us through Facebook. We'll be back in just a moment. This is St. Louis on the Air on St. Louis Public Radio, 90.7 KWMU. Hello again, and welcome back to our discussion. Today we are talking about stress and the role it plays and tendencies toward violence, particularly among young African Americans. My guests in studio, Dr. Cleopatra Howard Caldwell, Director of the Center for Research on Ethnicity, Culture, and Health at the University of Michigan School of Public Health, Dr. Lorena Estrada Martinez, Assistant Professor of Social Work at the Brown School of Social Work at Washington University. Let's go right to the phones. We have some folks who want to join us in the conversation. We'll begin by bringing in Jeff, calling from St. Louis. Jeff, thanks for being with us.
Thanks for taking my call. And first, I'm glad that the point about the disparity of sentences got all clarified. But to your defense, Don, to your guests, I know you've had quite a number of guests addressing exactly this point, so I know that you're very much aware of it. As an early childhood stressor, I want to know how much corporal punishment and other forms of harsh parenting have been looked at as an important element in the equation.
Well, there's been a lot of research that actually has looked at that, and there are two sides of it. There's research that suggests that children who have been exposed to corporal punishment may engage in violent behavior more because they find that as a way of learning responses. I'm not saying this very clearly, but learning violence as a way of life because they've been beaten. There are other research that says there's a difference between being able to spank a child and then being able to really abuse a child, and that there are distinctions that are made. In most cases, people suggest that it's better not to spank children because then they won't get into the habit of fighting. But in many cases, some schools now are really moving back to corporal punishment as a way of disciplining children. But I think the overwhelming majority of the child development literature suggests that you don't engage in corporal punishment as a way of rearing children.
Thank you for addressing that.
Dr. Estrada Martinez, did you want to add to that?
Just very briefly, and I agree there, most of the child development literature would point to corporal punishment sort of as a bad thing, and certainly when it reaches levels where we can classify it as child abuse, then certainly that's a big deal. But there's also issues of context, right? And we know that different minority groups might engage more frequently in corporal punishment of their children, but it's not, there's sort of a cultural spectrum in which you view things of corporal punishment. And for example, a lot of young African Americans live in neighborhoods that are really not safe. And so their parents might be much more authoritarian about where they can go, what can they do, who they can be around with. And if they are not compliant to what their parents are saying, they might sort of obviously not be beaten by their parents, but certainly there might be some level of corporal punishment. But there's important reasons, right? The parents are really trying to keep them safe from unsafe environments and might not have time to explain to the child what's going on in their neighborhoods, but rather need a sort of a quick way of saying, you need to get inside the house right now. Mm-hmm. And I think that the same is true with Latino parents as well.
By the way, go ahead.
No, I was going to say, but in many cases, when people are referring to corporal, they are talking about the beating. And there's all kinds of disagreements around whether or not you should hit a child, because hitting children would lead to violence. And that's one of those issues that's very gray. But I think Dr. Martina Estrada is absolutely right in terms of suggesting that there are ethnic differences in what people believe about whether or not they should spank a child. And the distinction between spanking and beating is where that gray area comes into play.
By the way, before I go back to the ones, how did you two get together? You're separated by several hundred miles.
Well, we didn't used to be.
Oh, okay. All right.
My graduate degree, my PhD and my postdoctoral fellowship were at the University of Michigan. Okay. So that's where we began our collaboration.
I see. Okay. Back to the phones. Let's bring in Kristen, who's calling from Imperial, Missouri. Kristen, thanks for waiting. You're on the air.
Hi. Thank you. I was wondering if you specifically looked at people from a low socioeconomic status versus people that may have had more opportunities, and if you saw any differences in that. And I was also wondering if you did see, you know, more violence in people from low socioeconomic status, did that carry over to females as well, or are you just seeing it predominantly in the male population?
Well, two things. Yes, we looked at females and males, and violent behaviors is really something that affects males at a much higher frequency than females. However, in this study, we also looked at depression as an outcome. So we sort of were comparing depression and violent behaviors, and we did see higher levels of depression among females than among males, which is consistent with the literature. But the trajectories through time were very different by gender, right? There were, for violent behaviors, it was fairly consistent. Males always had higher risk than females. And we looked at a variable that was a proxy for socioeconomic status. We looked at their level of education, whether they had completed high school on time or if they had taken, by the end of the study, if they had still yet to complete high school. And we also saw for violent behaviors that people who had completed high school on time had lower risk than those that had not yet completed by the end of the study.
We did have one really interesting gender difference finding that was related to depression, and it was for a particular age group. And that was for the males who were 21 to 25 years old. They tended to be more depressed. And that's something that's unusual, because typically we see females who are more depressed than males. And that was interesting, because your point is very well taken. In our sample, we tended to look at low income, and because we were in the Flint community, and it's an area that's very economically depressed. And in this particular situation, these were males at this particular age where they were experiencing many challenges, and most of their lives they had been experiencing challenges. This was an opportunity for them, you would think, to have looking to the future. But these males were actually experiencing much higher levels of depression than we anticipated that they would at this stage of development. So for us, this was really a clear indication that this was a hidden population in terms of the need for mental health services. So that's something that became extremely important.
Does the situation of depression and violence always come together, or is it possible to be dealing with one and not the other?
It is absolutely possible to deal with one and not the other. Sometimes there is a certain level of comorbidity, if you will, right? People who are highly depressed, they also might engage in violent behaviors, but those are very distinct outcomes in the mental health literature.
Let's take another call. Warren, go ahead, please. You're on the air.
One of the things I wanted to mention is about concerning stress. Now, my generation didn't have to suffer the stress that these younger people are having to stress, because we accepted our conditions more or less, and we had our own neighborhoods, we had our small businesses, so actually, we were almost like a nation living within a nation. So we didn't have the kind of, stress that these young people experience. And then there's another thing, other things rather, the hypocrisy of the justice system. Whereas we knew that that was the case, but we had a way of dealing with it, whereas these young people, it's hard for them to understand, you know, because they didn't experience the slave mentality or of segregation, total segregation that we did. So we would like a nation within a nation almost. And another thing that was bad, well meant, but this integration of the school system, we had our neighborhood schools, and our teachers had more authority. They were respected, and they understood their students more so than what was happening now. And the fact that our children have to be bused out of their own neighborhoods and things, that was not too good.
Well, Warren, thank you very much. We have the point. I want to give our guests time to respond to that. Dr. Caldwell, generational differences.
I think that's really a very important point that the caller raises, because one of the things we always have to take into context, the historical time that people are being raised in. And these youth today really do have expectations for a future, that they have opportunities, that they have expectations, that they can fully participate within society. So when they come across situations where they are being discriminated against and they perceive that they're being discriminated against, that it does present that extra level of stress. And I think that that's one of the things that we do have to pay attention to, and that we are trying to get a better handle on. And sometimes, especially when we're talking about levels of discrimination that may be even unintentional, that may be subtle, that it's not the intent of school systems sometimes to be discriminatory, that these youth have to find ways of coping with it and find ways of still achieving. And this is another reason why we look at protective factors, because not all youth in our study end up engaging in violent behavior. Not all youth in our study end up depressed. Not all youth in our study end up coming up with negative outcomes. So there are ways that youth do tend to manage this. But the caller's point is really very well taken, because another variable in our study is this kind of generalized stress. And I think that's a manifestation of an accumulation of these kinds of stressors over a number of experiences that youth can have. So I think that's really something that's that we are paying attention to.
Did you come up with any kind of a percentage as the percentage of young people who do turn to violence, who do become depressed?
Yes.
Well, we looked at the percentage of people who engaged in violent behavior for every year in this study, and we certainly saw that there was a decrease, a very pronounced decrease in violent behavior since the sort of end of adolescence into when they were 25 years of age. And I think only around 10 or 11% of our sample ended up engaging in violent behaviors across all of the waves. Most of them, I think, really engaged in violent behaviors at one point in time, and so they were counted in. When it comes to depression, we also saw fairly low levels of depression sort of across the board, and those were fairly consistent across all of the points in time in which we interviewed the participants.
Mm-hmm. Right. Well, let's go back to the phones then and bring in Charles calling from St. Louis. Charles, thanks for being with us. Go ahead.
Thank you, Don. I have a brief comment, and then I have a brief question. First of all, my comment is how Ms. Howard Cowles and Ms. Martinez's studies completely missed the impact of the gangster culture in fatherless families sounds to me at the very least of smacks of academic negligence on their part. The second thing I'd like to say is how would a 16-year-old child be experiencing stress from racism, a black child, when they have yet to enter in the cultural milieu of housing and employment? And I'll take my answers off the air. Thank you so much.
Well, I'll start by saying that we are looking at them as they're entering emerging adulthood. So we're dealing with 19 to 24-year-olds. So we're not dealing with the 16-year-olds. So they have had an opportunity to begin those kinds of adult responsibilities that would expose them to stress. And one of the things we also know from research is that African-American children in general assume many adult responsibilities at much earlier age than others. And experiencing discrimination begins at much younger ages as well. So there are opportunities for them to experience stress over the life course. So that's one point that I'd like to make. The other thing I'd like to also say is that I actually do work on families with non-resident fathers. And because they're non-resident doesn't mean that they're not involved. So we have many different types of family systems. So the call actually has made a huge generalization that really should not be assumed that all families have the same type of family experiences just because you say the word African-American. So we also want to make sure that we make very targeted kinds of comments when we're talking about it. So our study did pay attention to the kind of family systems and family supports that these youth have. Some are from families that the fathers are not present, but others do have support from both parents.
And I'm going to agree with Dr. Caldwell. We certainly have a sort of huge diversity in terms of household composition for this sample. And it is something that we looked at in the study. We did sort of adjust for the effect of living in a one-parent household versus other kinds of two parents or other kinds of compositions. So it is something that we did look at, except that it wasn't one of the main aspects of the study, right? We're trying to really look at stressors in multiple life domains. And certainly what Dr. Caldwell said is absolutely true. Just because you have not entered the workforce, the labor market, in an adult role does not mean that you're not experiencing different kinds of instances of racial discrimination through your young life, through your childhood and your adolescence.
Let's take a call from Jim. He may want to go in the same direction, but we'll find out. He's calling from St. Louis. Jim, go ahead, please.
Oh, thank you. I started listening about at least 10 minutes into the show, and maybe this was covered, but perhaps not in view of the caller before me. And that is whether the studies have been associated or correlated at all with, are the parents present in the home? Are they together? And are both neither alcoholics nor on drugs? And it could be grandparents if they're raising the child, but I have friends who have had foster children, African-American foster children, and then went on to adopt two girls because the mother, who was single and so on, just very young, couldn't handle it. They tried to get them back into her care and so on, but it was just not working out. And naturally, those girls would have been under a lot of stress moving from place to place and that kind of thing. I just wonder, because I've noticed a lot of, sometimes it's not so much the income level and that kind of thing as that home environment without the alcohol and the drugs and the absences of parents and that sort of thing.
Okay.
Thank you.
We need a quick response, Jim, if we can.
Well, certainly there has been a lot of previous work looking at parents' behaviors and their drug use or sort of substance abuse, and that has been strongly linked with children and adolescent outcomes. I think that we have to sort of make the distinction that this is an older group of youth, really. It's sort of technically they are adults, right? But certainly, yes, the point that the caller is making is very well taken. There is a lot of evidence to point in that direction.
Well, as we wrap this up, what now? You've got this information. What do you do with it, and how can it affect change?
Well, I think what now is that it brings to light the need for considering ways of intervening. And I think the intervention needs to be at multiple levels. So certainly there needs to be interventions that help youth cope better with the kinds of situations and circumstances that they're in. But there also needs to be consideration for policy initiatives that help us consider ways of reducing racism in the country in general. But speaking more specifically, I think there's a need for policies within school systems, for example, to address some of the issues around teacher training for in dealing with some of the circumstances that these youth may be facing within school systems at an earlier age. There may be needs for policies that help us address things like employment situations, because we also know that African-American youth are less likely to enter the labor market at an earlier age than some other populations. And there are other ways that we can think about addressing interventions that might be helpful for family circumstances, because families are the first line of helping youth cope with any type of race-related stress that they have. So I think there are a number of opportunities for intervention.
All right. Well, keep us in mind as you pursue this line of research. We thank you very much, Professor Estrada Martinez. Thank you for being with us. Professor Caldwell, Dr. Caldwell, Dr. Estrada Martinez, thank you so much for being with us.
Thank you for having us.
Filling us in on this report.
Thank you.
Coming up, Tony La Russa joins us. We'll be talking about what else? Baseball. This is St. Louis on the Air on St. Louis Public Radio, 90.7 KWMU.